So that's the homework statistics. The solutions are currently online. There are the solutions for question 1 and for 2 and 3. And for question 0, obviously, you guys wrote what it is that you were missing from Google. I have a summary of some of your answers that the TA gave me. But I thought a more interesting idea is to make you do the work. So I will open a topic on the blog. I'll open a topic on the blog, and then all of you just get to write down the answer that you gave. The answer that you gave for the zeroth question. That'll be kind of interesting to see. Some of the answers I have looked at, they're still not particularly demanding. You're not really expecting too much out of your search engines. All you're saying is, in one way you can say that if only it was in blue color instead of green, you know, that's the sort of, you're giving too much benefit to the search engine. So still it might be worth looking at what other people were missing and how much similarity is there in what people were missing in the search engine. So I'll open a topic. All you guys have to do is each of you just write down your answer, the one that you had in the homework on the web, and then everybody gets to see it. So the other interesting thing is I was returning the homeworks today, and I was retrieving you guys using your homeworks, and I was using TF-IDF. TF being, if you spoke a lot or you sent lots of comments, I probably had figured out who you were. And IDF being, if you had some distinguishing characteristic, such as long hair like Brandon, or pretty face like one of those guys, I remember. The rest of you, I had to ask your name. So we do use TF-IDF in day-to-day life to figure out. So find out something unique that you guys can have so that I'll remember you. It'll be useful. One other way I remember people is white basketball players. This is a undergraduate class with actually 3 undergraduates, the rest graduate students. So I think of undergraduate students as white basketball players, and so I remember all of them. They're okay. But the rest of you, make sure that you become distinguished somehow. Unless you don't want to be, unless you want to stay under the radar and get through the semester. Okay. So this is the agenda for today's class. Before I go into that, are there any questions? No questions. Okay. So what I'm going to do essentially is one topic which is a slightly closer look at inverted indices. We actually mentioned it earlier, but since you also need to use it in the project one, I thought you may as well look at it slightly more closely. And then transition into information retrieval on the web, directly doing search engines using information retrieval. And we will talk about what are the most important differences between information retrieval on the web versus traditional information retrieval. You already know some of the answers, but we'll spend some time differentiating them. And then essentially spend time, we'll realize that there are like 3 important issues. One is there is no document corpus. You have to go find the document corpus by crawling. So we'll talk about crawling. The other is that web pages have more structure on them than a normal document, and so can you use the structure? And so that's basically using tags to improve retrieval. And then the third is essentially the fact that there is link structure across web pages. Can we exploit that? And to do that, before we jump into PageRank and authorities hubs, I would use that as the reason to talk about social networks, which is just like IR is the background for the retrieval part of the web search. Social network is the background, traditional background, for PageRank and Authorities Hub types of ideas. So we'll look at that and then come to PageRank and Authorities Hub. Okay, so that's the idea. If in fact things go, this probably up to here, just segueing into social networks is probably what I might be able to do today. And then next class would be social networks mostly. Okay. And the slides for that are already online. I sort of gave an approximate idea of topics to come. Those are the dates, and so today we'll do indexing, retrieval, crawling, and start the information retrieval and web business. And 8th and 13th probably would be social networks, and 15th onwards we'll do link analysis, which is PageRank, Authorities Hubs, etc. Okay. Again, it's not that you can't talk about link analysis without knowing social networks. In fact, the last few times I taught this course, I taught it directly without talking about social networks. But the same thing can be said, you don't need to know information retrieval to start directly using it on the web. But having the traditional information retrieval background helps you give more depth to what actually the search engines are doing. Okay, it's not as much what they're currently doing, it's what else they could have done that gives you the competitive advantage if you're trying to do something different. Okay, so that's the reason why we'll go back and look at social networks. Okay. So the first thing that we're going to look at is the information retrieval. I'm sorry, the inverted indices. So you know that essentially the way you will represent your term document matrix is here are your documents and here is your terms, and you know the documents have weights with respect to these terms. These weights could be TF-IDF weights. These could be raw frequencies, whatever you want. Okay, and then finally, one other thing that is useful to have is for each document, you may as well remember, along with the document, its magnitude. If you think of the document as a vector, since we're going to do vector space similarity, the magnitude is a vector. One step back, much of what I'm going to discuss in the context of both inverted indices and crawling are really about doing good engineering. Okay. Doing a crawler, anybody can do. Doing the best crawler requires lots and lots of engineering. Unfortunately, that's not exactly the kind of thing that excites me most. Okay, so even if I'm not able to convey to you the great excitement of indexes and crawling, please don't think that those topics are not interesting. In fact, if you have to have the search engine working, you need to have to deal with the engineering tricks to make sure that the retrieval can be done in fractional times and that crawling can be done efficiently. Okay, so I will tell you to the extent I will appreciate it, I will tell you what are the important issues, but then I also give you readings, and engineering is hard to teach. It's easier to sort of, these are case studies and it's not the best thing to teach in a class, maybe at least for me. So I'm just coming out ahead and telling you that I may not make this sound very exciting to you guys, but that doesn't mean that it's not exciting. In fact, if you ever were to try and talk to any guy working in any of these search engine companies, they will ask you all these data structure oriented issues, because you have to first cross over them before you get to do nicer things like, should I be doing LSI, should I be doing various other, link analysis in this way versus that way. Okay, so engineering is important. Okay, so now the reason you are actually keeping the magnitude next to the document is really because you don't want to have to recompute it every time a query comes. This is like engineering 101. To the extent queries keep coming, and every time you get a query to be compared to the document, you need to compute its magnitude, and why would you want to do it many times? If the document isn't changing, why not just compute it and keep it? Okay, so in general, one important thing is pre-compute as much as possible. pre-compute as much as possible, because so that the hottest real estate is after the user gives the query and hits the return, up to the time you send your top 10 results back to the user. That's the hottest real estate. Nobody cares how much time you spent before that, and nobody cares how much time you spend while the user is looking at their results. So to make sure that you can do the delay between querying to the first 10 results, you can do the important issue is how fast can you do that. And normally the top level ideas are you can pre-compute as much as possible, and you also try to cache as many things as possible, which are like connected. Pre-computing, you computed the document magnitude and you cached it so that you don't have to recompute it. Okay, now this is just the beginning, right? Now, one idea is to, let's see, if you got a query, what would you do to compare it to the document? The naive idea, of course, which you would do if you just have a couple of documents, is you have the document itself represented essentially as the terms and their weights, and the query itself is the terms and the weights of the query, and then the query has its magnitude, document has its magnitude, and you compare each query to each document. I mean, the query to each of the documents. Okay, and compute what is the similarity. We are assuming for the rest of this discussion that we have decided to sell our soul to vector similarity. No more, multiples. Should we be doing Jaccard similarity? Should we be doing something else? We'll just do vector similarity. Okay. So it's basically a question of dot product between this vector and this vector. That's all you're going to do. It's very cheap. Now, the dumbest the first idea that would come, which would not be really that dumb, if you only have a couple of documents and the query is about the size of the document, is to do the following thing. For each document, for each term that appears in the document, look to see if that term also appears in the query. If so, you multiply the term frequency in the document by the term frequency in the query, or term weight in the document by term weight in the query, and keep that partial sum around. Okay, simple enough idea. And then when you fall out of this document loop, for each document you actually get the similarity with respect to the query for the document is just whatever accumulated partial sum divided by your magnitude that you already have. Okay. Now, and then of course display the top K to the user. So the question is, what's wrong with this idea? If you haven't thought about it, these kinds of things essentially should send shivers through your spine if you want to deal with large scale data, because you should think, this is okay, but my God, this is hugely inefficient. Yes?
Can we initially exclude documents which don't contain any query terms?
Yeah, you could do that. That's one idea. But in general, that's like a band-aid. So that actually brings up an issue, which is really the query has much fewer terms than the document. Okay? Most terms in the query are not going to be present in most documents. Now, even documents themselves are very sparse. Okay? If you think of the lexicon, right, if you think of the dictionary, the vocabulary, as let's say a million words, not every document has all the million words. So in fact, each of these document vectors are highly sparse. Most of their values are zero. Okay, now the way I'm writing this, in essence, I'm going to do this for each term. So for each document, I'm doing work which is proportional to the size of the vocabulary, even though the vocabulary documents don't have all the vocabulary words. Okay, and then go look to see if the query has that word. Now the problem is, it's not just the multiplication, it's the lookup itself that's going to cost you. Okay? So the question, of course, is, can I just avoid doing it that way? So it needs access to most non-zero entries in the document term matrix. And so the idea, of course, is inverted index, which allows you to think in terms of, given a term, what are all the places it appears? The things that are common between queries and documents are terms, right? So if you think of your document corpus not in terms of what are the words appearing in position 1, position 2, position 3, but in terms of what are the documents that have this word and where do they have it. So you're thinking inverted way, which is basically what you always think of as indexes in your textbooks and so on. So if you think of it that way, then you can actually do much better, because in effect what you would do is you'll only start with the terms that are in the query, first of all. So query is much smaller, so you're going to start with only the terms that are in the query. And the secondly, for each of those terms, you know their inverted index. If you go to the index, it will tell you which documents have those terms and exactly where are they. And also, what are the weights for those terms in those documents. So this way, you can automatically consider exactly the documents that are relevant and multiply their weights to the query weights and be done with it. Okay? So that's basically the idea. Now, so here is an example of inverted files. So this is just a document here, and the inverted index for this, so essentially will say that the word A appears in position 1, 4, and 40 in this document. Entry appears in 11, 20, 31. File appears in 238, and so on. Okay, that's your inverted file, and then you can then write it as a nice little index, which essentially can be thought of as you have the index is in terms of all the words that are appearing in the document. And if you're doing full search, full text search, that means any word can be used as the keyword, right? Then essentially this is your lexicon itself. This is your dictionary of all the words, okay? And for each of the words, you can, for example, have the information about number of documents. In this particular case, here is one way of representing your inverted index data structure. For each word, the number of documents in which that word appears. Okay, and then you have a pointer into the memory giving you information about exactly which document it appears and where in those documents it appears. Okay, so here 20 times it appears, and here is a list of documents. 34, it occurs 6 times in positions 1, 118, 2087, etc. Now, this information is useful. The positional information is useful if you are into doing proximity search, for example. Okay, that simple vector similarity doesn't care about proximity search, but you can use this to figure out the proximity search information. Okay, and then so on. So again, this one, 39 occurrences, and here are exactly the occurrence index. Okay. So you essentially, this is what you have. This is your data structure for inverted index. And given such a data structure, then all you need to do is, I'm skipping over some slides because this is like very elementary data structures ideas. I'm repeating what I just said. So you can read them. But the important issue is, how does the retrieval work with inverted indices? Now, in upfront, you initialize all the similarities between the queue and database documents to zero, assume that. And then now you start, the for loop starts this way, for each term TJ in document, in the query queue. Previously, the for loop was document centric. Now it is term centric and query centric. It starts with the terms in the query, okay? And then basically get the inverted index for the term T, okay? And then for each document that is listed in the index I of this term T, then you know the weight. If you have, for example, for now let's just think in terms of number of occurrences itself is the weight, just the TF is the weight, okay? So you have the number of occurrences, okay? So then all you do is you multiply the weight for that term in the query by the weight for that term in this document. Okay, so in one fell swoop, you essentially incremented the partial similarity for all the documents that contain TJ. Now you look at TK, and again increment all the documents which have TK. Okay, and then of course, in the end, you do one pass through the documents And for each document, you essentially normalize the similarity. And this, by this time, when you come here, it has already kept the weights, the components for each of the terms in the document that are common with the query. Those are all being taken into account. They've been summed up. Okay. Then you sort your document in the descending similarities and display the top k. Now the nice thing is there are lots and lots of good things about this approach compared to the previous approach, not surprisingly. If a document does not contain any term of a given query, then you would never even consider document D. So its similarity will remain zero. Okay, so you would not take something and see is it similar to the query. And then only the non-zero entries in the columns in the document term matrix are actually used, because each term points out only the document where it is actually appearing. Appearing means appearing non-zero number of times. So you don't have to deal with the zero entries. Okay? And in some sense, you are computing the similarities of the multiple documents simultaneously. So for example, one can argue that this has a notion of any time. And any time computation is something, this is actually a good buzzword to keep in your mind. And any time computation is something which, if you stop the computation before it ends, the result you get still has some partial utility. Okay? Most computations, if you think in terms of the time given to your program and the utility of the result, that means how useful it is of the result, most computations that you ever learned, right, have this following kind of profile. So you have to let the program run until it's done. And if you stop, I mean, you know this with Windows, right? I mean, if it's doing something, some long computation, and if you just 3 seconds before, if you stop it, you get junk, nothing. Okay? So this is not good, because if you suddenly run out of time, you got nothing, zero. What you would like to have is a kind of computation which is anything but this, really. Which is anything but this. This is the worst possible scenario for computation. And you should feel happy that all computations you learned till now are of this type. Okay, this is what you wasted your life on till now. So start thinking about things which have partial utility. You know, somewhere, if you stop them in the middle. So the best would be something which goes like that. So the utility nicely varies as the time is increased. Okay? But something else, maybe it may look like that. Anything other than the step function. Now, I would say that doing partial similarities of all the documents with respect to the query in one fell swoop has the following advantage. Suppose the query has 250 terms, which never happen on the web. But you somehow ran out of time and you did 200 of them. Okay? You can stop there and you still have the best documents which seem to match this query in terms of the first 250 terms. Right? Which is still something useful compared to the final answer, of course, is documents which are matching on all 250 terms and in terms of the degree of match. This one will give you all the documents that are matching on the first 250 terms, the first 200 terms best. The previous one will just give you the first 10 documents, or first 3,000 documents I finally managed to complete by the time you called me. Of those, this is the best. Now that doesn't tell me anything, because the best in the top, you know, best in the first 3,000 you did has no connection to the final answer. Okay? One thing you should keep in mind is in the web scenarios is, can you think of doing any time computation? It's not just web scenarios. It's nice to be able to interrupt computation, because otherwise you have to schedule the right amount of time for the computation upfront, which is too hard to do. Okay. Now one can actually talk about this any stuff can other things, any space computation. Okay, I mean, I'm digressing, but I want you to think in terms of computations which are not just step functions. Because most of your computations, algorithms that you learned are not any space computations. They require certain amount of memory. If you give them one byte less, they die. And they give you nothing. Okay? And those of you who have done, you know, AI class, intro to AI class, you know, for example, that memory restricted search algorithms are a classic example of any space search algorithm. Okay? So you may want to do any space, any time sort of computation, but this one is what we were talking about right there. Now, since I've done so much of this, and since many of you probably haven't heard about this, remember the sorting algorithms that you learned, right? They're all the same. The only thing you ever cared about the sorting algorithms is all of them are supposed to give the completely sorted sequence, so whoever gives it faster wins. So you spent your lifetime trying to figure out 15,000 or 5 sorting algorithms, you know, some of which are O n log n, some of which are O n squared, which is bad, some of which are O n factorial, which are really bad, and, you know, so you figured out which is the best in terms of, you know, who gets done faster. Because everybody was supposed to give the complete sequence. Suppose your sequence was so big that nobody can actually sort it in the time that you have. So your sequence is very large, and you may not be given enough time to complete the sorting. So you know upfront that you may be stopped from completing the sorting. Then you want to ask yourself, if I am rudely interrupted, can I still give something useful? Now if you look at your sorting algorithms from the point of view of everybody does the same exact thing when they get done. They give a completely sorted sequence. But if you look at what they do on the way to the completely sorted sequence, they're all very different. They're all very different. They have very different kind of intermediate behavior. If you think in terms of these are the items, and this is their actual sorted position. Okay, and when in the current partially sorted sequence, when they're done, presumably you would have something like this. Each item is put in its correct final position. Okay, that is where it will look like in the end. The question is, what happens in the middle? Some sorting algorithms go like this. So in the beginning, the positions are like a big bubble, a cloud, which becomes thinner and thinner and thinner. Okay? So globally, the sequence is becoming more and more sorted as you go on. But now nobody is guaranteed to be in the correct position until everything is done. But everybody is likely to get more and more closer to their final position. You know these kind of sorting algorithms. Okay, then there are other sorting algorithms which go this way. Right? So you get the first item in the correct position. Then you get the second item in the correct position. Then you get the third item in the correct position. So if you stop them in the middle, you get the top k in the correct position. But the rest, you have no guarantee as to how close are they to the correct position. Okay, now, depends on what you want to do. You know, if what you're trying to show is the top k answers, it's quite clear that you should be using this. If on the other hand, what you're trying to show is a sequence which is closest to the final sorted sequence in a sort of a all pairs distance measure, then you're much better off with the bubble sort. Okay, think in terms of what happens not just at the end, but also in the middle. Because it helps, because sometimes you may not have time all the way to the end, and so you have to stop the computation in the middle. And things which you thought were identical from the point of view of the end actually have very different characteristics from the point of view of the middle. And given these very different characteristics, the time aspect of the sorting algorithms is less important. If you're talking about O n log n versus O n log n plus a small constant, who cares? If what you really care is top k versus, you know, reducing the distance across all the elements. Okay. Now, there's an example for the efficient retrieval that you can go through. I don't need to actually go through this, but you know, here are, you know, if you are in doubt, you know, here is a query, here are some documents, here is how the inverted index would look like. Okay, for each term, it's showing what are the documents where it occurs and what are the weights in those documents. And then if you have that, given this query, you can see after each term is processed, what the similarities would look like. Okay, so after each term is processed, you have similarities for all the documents. Okay? Now, you can, having said this, then let's see. There are all sorts of extensions that you can do. This is like the bare bones basic ideas of inverted index. You can do a lot more little tricks which can improve the efficiency further and further. Okay. So for example, one of the issues is TF-IDF weights. I've been acting as if it's just raw weights that I care about, you know, raw occurrences. But I really want TF and IDF because that's a great idea. Okay. Now, if you're thinking of TF-IDF, the question would be, do you pre-compute or do you compute on demand? For TF, it's clear, pre-computing, because the document itself doesn't change that much. What about IDF? IDF can change because IDF is a global property. How common a term is, is dependent on who else, what other documents are there in the corpus. Especially in the context of something like web search, where you keep crawling and getting more and more new documents, if you are strict, you would say that IDF has to be recomputed every day after each crawl. Okay? But one can say that if you do that, essentially you're doing an extra computation of IDF at the time after the query has come. You're doing it at least once after each crawl. If you just do it once and keep it, then you take a hit. It's no longer exactly the IDF that you're looking for. But it's fine. And one of the things we'll do is, after all this search engine discussion is over, you'll read at least one paper, the old Google paper, when these guys were grad students, they wrote a paper. After that, they stopped. You know, the lawyers told them not to ever write any papers. So where they talk about what engineering decisions they made at the time when it had, I think, millions of documents, not billions of documents. And you'll see that they cut all sorts of corners. Okay, and what would be interesting is to see how many corners were cut. And, you know, most of the time you cut corners because you want to reduce the time spent in, you know, computing the similarity. Okay. One more thing I want to mention. There is a slide which went away. Okay. There are other variations. This should actually be there. For example, in the inverted index, the address space, the way I gave it, is kind of flat. So you say document, coordinate in the document. One idea you could do is you can hierarchically store these documents, saying here is a big bin of documents of one type, here is another bin of another type, here is another bin of another type. And when I have a term, it first tells me which are the bins I should be looking at. And once you go to the bin, you look at the inverted index for that bin alone, for example. This is something that you will read in the Google paper, Anatomy of Google Search Engine. Okay, you can start reading it, by the way. There is nothing stopping you from reading it in case you are interested in, you know, this point. Okay. That's essentially flat versus hierarchical address space. And whether or not you pre-compute TF-IDF. Furthermore, when you have web pages, as we'll see in a minute, you know, it's not just enough to talk about what positions are the what positions are the terms occurring in the database, in the document, but also under what context. So what is the font size of this word in that position? Okay, because presumably if somebody said, look at this in like 15,000 size font, then presumably the user felt that is the most important word in the document. Okay, and you should take that into account. I mean, even in normal documents, you know, when you look at indexes at the end of the textbook, not all occurrences of the word are given equal prominence. For example, sometimes they will say, you know, a word, let's say, you know, meridian, magnetic meridian, and they'll say 212 in bold. That means that's the 212 page is the one where magnetic meridian was discussed most prominently. And then say with commas 102, 705, 907. So these are other pages where it's been mentioned in passing, but it's not the most important mention. But in essence, somebody used subjective understanding to figure out what's the, I mean, since the textbook index is made by editors, human editors, they gave, you know, which occurrences are more important, which occurrences are less important. In the context of web, you can use the font information, the color information, is it blinking or not? All these things are the header information, is it H2 or H1 or H3? All of these can be used. Okay, and that can, in essence, what will happen there is this information will be used along with the TF-IDF information to compute the effective weight of the term in the document. See, not each occurrence gives the same, not each occurrence of the word in the document need to give the same impact on its overall weight in the document. If you have the word occurring twice in both documents, except in this document it occurs in H1, which is, you know, big words, and in this document it occurs in hidden or footnote size, then clearly this is less important than this, and you can handle that too. Okay, so those are kind of things. The other big thing which I'm going to skip because I find it not particularly interesting to me, but it is interesting, very important, is compression strategies. These indices are really, really large. The index themselves are large. Okay, how do you compress them? How do you keep them as much as possible in the main memory? Now, these are things that you need some database genes in you to feel that, you know, indexing is important. But, you know, unfortunately I don't. So I'm telling you up front that this is important, but, you know, I don't make it sound important. So you should ignore me and still learn about some of this stuff. I will give you sites to compression strategies. Okay. There are actually courses on this that are taught purely from data structures point of view. How to do search from a data structures point of view. Who cares what you're computing? Let's compute it fast. That's just as important. You know, my bias, because of, you know, the way I come to this material, is I tend to think of what am I computing more than how am I computing. Okay. But both are important. Okay. Questions on this stuff? Yes. You do all sorts of ways. For example, one thing you could do is to keep the, if you have an abstract, I mean, hierarchical address space, you can keep part of it in the main memory. Okay? And furthermore, I believe that, in fact, you know, these days it's not that hard. I mean, we should look at it, actually. It's not that hard to find out some of these numbers for some of the search engines. And keeping index in main memory is not out of the question. Okay? Yes, that's the answer. But if you are in trouble, you can always either buy more memory or consider hierarchical address space such that you can keep the hierarchical, the higher part, higher level part in the memory, lower level part you have to go down. Other questions? One thing I should mention is that this is the minimum you need to do for your project one, because if you're doing, you know, inverted indices, at least this, and you can do better, but this is minimum. Okay. Just as in a sorting class, you can't start by saying, let me take a permutation of the sequence and see if it is sorted. If not, let me take another permutation and see if it is sorted. It's a great sorting algorithm, n factorial, gets done very fast, but you know that's like the worst thing you can do. Okay, so similarly in retrieval, you should never do anything other than inverted index based retrieval. But that's the base level, you know, and then you do better. Okay, so I sort of already talked about much of what I've done in terms of information retrieval as well as indexing until now. I'm having these two different hats on. On one hand, I'm saying, look, it's just traditional retrieval. But every once in a while, we do talk about how each of the issues that we're talking about affect search engines, right? For example, when we looked at LSI, we talked about whether or not LSI is used and how you could use LSI on the top 100 results to do clustering, etc. Okay, so there is leakage between the traditional versus the search engine technology, at least in the discussion. But now we will actually turn directly to the search engines and say, look, if I'm only doing information retrieval for the search engines, what's so different? Why can't I just do it? You know, I already know traditional information retrieval, why can't I just apply it? So this would be a place where you consider talking about all the things that are different about web search compared to traditional information retrieval. And this is hard for you guys because you don't know what the heck is traditional information retrieval. You only know web search. Okay, so in some sense, all you know about traditional information retrieval is what I was telling you. And I said, these things like LexisNexis, people give, you know, think of information retrieval in libraries, where there are documents, there are books that have been cataloged, somebody might even write keywords for these, and then they are then inverted indexed in terms of these keywords, and a librarian is trying to retrieve you the right document. And if you, you know, remove the librarian and put a computer program, that would be your LexisNexis. Okay. Given that, starting from there, if you look at web search, what are the obvious differences? You know, here are some, and I believe these are the most important, but you should try to tell me if I'm missing something. Okay, because again, you know web search. So first thing is web pages are voluminous and diversified. There's too many of them. You know, LexisNexis, for example, might be talking about newspaper articles that have appeared various places, or you know, articles in medical journals. Those are much fewer in comparison to the number of web pages. Okay, and they're very diverse in the sense each page is really so. The general search engine really is not topic specific at all. You know, anybody can ask any question about anything, and it tries to keep them equally happy or unhappy. In essence, okay. So both diversity and highly voluminous, and of course these pages themselves are not in any single place. They are distributed all over the many servers. So the big problem because of this is you don't even know all the documents in one single database, which you assume for IR, right? So in IR you start by saying here is my big bucket of all the documents. Let me start indexing them, etc. For search engines, there is no big bucket of documents. You have a bucket which is empty, waiting to be filled, and you need to go get these documents. In fact, one of the biggest selling points which differentiates one search engine from other search engine is how big is that bucket? How much have they crawled? Right? And so, of course, and then the pages change. You know, in library, books don't keep having new editions. But pages change all the time. And just because a word appeared on the page 10 days back, you shouldn't retrieve it if it doesn't any longer appear. Okay, this is an issue too. So this whole thing essentially requires this set of challenges. I kind of club them together and I say, you need to build your own corpus and keep rebuilding them every morning or every week. Okay, and what you do there is crawling. And you need to understand how crawling is done. And more importantly, it's not like you crawl once and you're done. You keep crawling. You keep getting more and more web pages from the web and bringing them into the document. Now, what helps this crawling really is that pages are connected to each other. And hopefully, if you get to one page, it kind of points way to some other pages. Then you go from there to some other pages. You go from there to other pages and bring them all together inside your bucket, which is what crawlers do. And they want to do it efficiently. Furthermore, they're going to redo this whole thing tomorrow morning, because the last page that I got, you know, 2 days back may have changed already, and so I have to refresh it. And efficient ways of doing this will also require you to figure out, how much time should I spend? I mean, how many times should I refresh a particular page, particular document? That depends on two factors, at least. One is, how fast does it seem to change? You can compute this from history. You know, if the last few times it seems to be changing, every time you go back it seems to be changing, versus every time you go back it seems to be the same, then you can you can estimate the rate of change of the document. Okay? The second issue is, who cares if the document is changing if it's not important? If nothing seems to ever hit this document in your query, you don't care. So in a way, handling this is all about crawling, and doing crawling efficiently, doing re-crawling efficiently. Okay, that's a very big engineering problem. The second issue is, this is like, this one is a problem and you have to solve it. Crawling is the solution. This one is an opportunity. Compared to normal documents, web pages have more structure, right? You have this rendering structure, at least. Presentation regularities are there. You have colors, you have big fonts versus small fonts. Everything at least is in HTML, and HTML you have at least some ways of making some things more prominent versus less prominent, smaller font versus larger font, etc. And you can use that, because to the extent somebody made the page, they probably had decided to make something big means they wanted it to be more important. Okay? So you should basically, as I was saying earlier, you should take this information into account, at least this information into account, in improving the term weights. Not just the number of occurrences, but also the prominence of those occurrences. Okay. In fact, one interesting thing that Google does, you'll see in the old paper at any rate, is it doesn't even consider the occurrences of a word in a document beyond the first 4,000 words. Are some number. So irrespective of how many million pages your document is, it only more or less cares about the first few pages. The assumption is that anything important about this document should have come in the first few pages, which is very important for you if you are writing novels, writing papers, not novels. Novel you can't give away the ending. But for papers, you want to give away the ending. Because if it's not in the introduction, and if you're saving it for the end, like a big climax, the reviewers have already left. They're no longer reading your paper. And so the climax is played to the empty audience. So you do have to give away the climax in paper, right? And so that's more or less what they do. You know, basically, if it is too far down, then probably it's not important. Okay, they're very extensively linked, which is pages connect to each other. That's also an opportunity. In fact, because they're connected to each other, you can solve this problem. Because you can crawl. How would you crawl if you don't know how to go from place to place? Because most pages seem to be connected to each other, indirectly or directly, you can crawl. Okay, so this is sort of an opportunity list. Now, this, on the other hand, is an issue of, it actually is a challenge, which is web search is very noisy, okay, because pages with high similarity to the query may still differ in relevance. Just because the words are present in the query, the users may still not like them. And they are also, in fact, part of the noisiness comes because not everybody gets to write a book and put it in the library. To write a book, you first of all need discipline. You have to sit down, write the book, get an ISBN number, and then get libraries to buy it. Okay? Every one of you can make a web page. And every one of you can make a web page with any content on it, right? Except in some countries where you can't, but in most countries you can. You can write any page and write whatever you want, and you can call names to people. You can say, "I am Bush" on your page, and how the heck are people who are supposedly looking for Bush supposed to differentiate between your page which says "I am Bush" and his page which says "I am Bush"? Because he doesn't even say that. I mean, he's trying to avoid saying "I'm Bush." I mean, saying the others are Bush, but that's a different story. So, anybody can make any page and say anything. And you know, like basically you can get large amount of misleading information. There was pre-filtering that went on in traditional information retrieval. First of all, you got to get dweebs who have discipline to sit in a room and write a book over some number of months and years. Second, you need a publisher who looks at this book and publishes it, and then gets an ISBN number, and then libraries will get that book. So it cuts down people who feel like just making a prank. You still had vanity press. People will pay and, you know, get their book published and probably donate copies to the library, etc. But it required, if you want to publicize yourself that way, you needed to at least pay big bucks. With web, you can do it now very easily. You can put any page anywhere, right? And furthermore, it's not only that people can do this, but they are, in fact, increasingly web search is adversarial. It's not that the library is library and your query is just trying to figure out the most relevant documents. Well, the documents themselves are not trying to mislead you, right? But on the web search, it's nothing like that. It's in fact, everybody tries to, you know, basically write whatever they want to increase the possibility that a search engine will hit that page. So if you're just looking at the pure IR things, you find out what are the query words that seem to be appearing most regularly on the query logs. By the way, this information is available, you know, various places publicize query logs. So for example, you know, Google and Yahoo publicize what are the most frequent queries for the last 6 month period. Okay, and then, you know that that's the one people are looking for, so you go ahead and put those words. And if it helps to have multiple copies of those words, you put multiple copies of them. And if too many of the Britney Spears is reducing the impact of what it is that you're trying to sell, what do? You put white on white in Britney Spears. You know, Britney Spears is written in white font on the white background, so people don't see it, machines do. Right? This is done, in fact, it's an old trick, now it no longer works. Okay, but yes. All sorts of things, exactly. No, but I mean, there are various ones of this. In fact, one of the interesting issue is anything important in the world which has any economic incentive is going to be an arms race. Okay, spam mail. Why do you keep getting spam mail despite the fact that people are bending over backwards to stop spam from coming? Because there is an economic incentive, and people are going to be, I mean, the people who are generating spam are just as intelligent as the people who are trying to stop the spam. Right? That's an unfortunate thing, because there's money to be made, so the smart guys will go to make the money. And so you have to increasingly improve. It's the same thing for viruses and us. You know, we try to, and we, not us, I mean, the evolution basically is a raging battle between viruses and organisms. No, viruses are also organisms, okay? And, you know, it never stops, okay? So, but the adversarial aspect does change the nice stoic information retrieval. It's not like the documents are your friends. Documents are your enemies. They actually are disguising themselves, and yet you have to find the right document. Okay? And so this is a big difference. So somehow you have to consider aspects other than just the fact that the words appear in that document. And one idea, of course, is to consider what do we do? So for example, if I'm trying to find a service, you know, I need something done in my home, so I look at the Yellow Pages. If there is only one guy in the greater Phoenix area who does that thing, I go get that guy. If there are 10 pages of listings of, you know, we pay into your home, and, you know, the question is, who am I going to call? What do? I'll call my friend and say, you recently had a paint job, and you know, I noticed that your home is still standing, so who did you get it done with? And then I go get that person, right? So there is an issue of, you use the social network to cut down. Of all the people who are doing painting, you're trying to cut down and say, these people I'll trust, these I won't trust. Okay, now on the web pages, there is an implicit social network because pages point to each other. And in some sense, the only way you can ever differentiate between me writing on my page, I am Bush, and White House writing on its page, you know, this is real Bush page. And I can also say, this is real Bush page, right? Who are they going to trust if you don't know any domain semantics? It has to be something other than the words. It has to be something based on social network analysis, link analysis, which is essentially what we'll get to. Okay? So, and then of course, so challenge, opportunity, challenge. So I have to give you an opportunity. Web users are your opportunity. They are those who are easy to please. And just look at yourself. You know, most of you are not unhappy with Google, which should tell you something. You know, you basically are very easy to please. If something that sort of like what you might be looking for when you already watered down your queries, such that the things that Google can do are the things that I'm going to search for. Other things I'll talk to my wife or, you know, I'll talk to my students to get these things done. So we first of all reduce the demands on the search engines and then are pleasantly surprised that anything reasonable is happening. So we are easy to please. Okay, that cannot be underestimated. You give a doctor who is searching for the right document about a particular treatment for a particular type of cancer, and this woman gave a 3-paragraph description of her query, and you do the Google style analysis and say, oh, this document seems to, you know, have 5 of these words, why don't you take it? That's the last time they'll ever use yours. Okay, so in that scenario, essentially there are areas where people are much more picky. They're not just happy that you got something related to something I'm looking for somewhere in the top K. Okay, so in a way, this I believe is a huge opportunity. So let's hope that humans don't become particularly hard to please and they remain sort of dulled without much special training. Okay, but unfortunately this should change. Okay. Now, so these are the things I was pointing out. So this challenge requires us to do crawling. Okay. This opportunity can be used to improve search, links and tags. This challenge can be handled again using one idea is to use social network to propagate importance, propagate trust, propagate number of citations, etc. Ultimately, you're using the social network defined by the links. Okay, and then this is good. I mean, you have to thank God that people are easy to influence. Okay, questions on that? That's sort of the most important slide from the point of view of why we need a slightly different theory for IR. I mean, web search compared to IR. And this is my attempt at sort of separating out pieces, but probably there are better ways of doing it too. But questions? Yes. Now, so let me change my hat and say that in this case, actually, web comes out ahead. Because in case of libraries, you assume that whatever is in the library is whatever is in the library. You know, you're never going to ask, why isn't this book in the library? Well, nobody wrote it. Or we are too poor to buy because, you know, local government shut down libraries. Okay? So you don't complain as to why documents are not present in the library. Among the documents, give me the best. On the web, in some sense, actually, you are much more, you expect that the best deals are presented to you. So the crawlers have to do extra work to get as much of the data. In fact, the databases that you're talking about, which we'll get to, in fact, one of the big points that he's making is the static web pages, the web pages which have some HTML and this sit there without, you know, they always sat there waiting for a query to come, are a very small fraction of the web. That's the one that you seem to be looking at, but those are the very small fraction of the web. Most web pages are generated on demand from a back-end database, and they disappear after your query is over. Okay, and one of the interesting things that crawlers do now is they actually ask queries, get these materialized pages, and store them as if they are they are actually static pages. Yes. Yes, deep web, invisible web, etc. So these are webs which have no static URL. They have URL which is essentially a query, which then the database answers the query and generates the HTML page, which for your session is a page. That's exactly what invisible web is, and depending on who you talk to, anywhere between 80% to 90% of the web is invisible. But then, because it's invisible, you have no real clue whether or not it's true. You know, I mean, these are various estimates that have been made. But it does, it's a different set of opportunities and challenges in some sense, because invisible web tends to be more structured than the normal web. Remember, I talked in the beginning classes about information extraction and the fact that if somebody put, you know, a bunch of data about countries and their capitals in a relational database, and then they put a little web front engine, you know, front end, and which accepts queries and says, what's the capital of India? And says in its own stilted English, the capital of India is New Delhi, period. Okay, I mean, then it's a very stylized piece of English. You can invert the English back into the tuple India, New Delhi. Okay, you can take the line, skip, 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 pick the word, skip, 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 pick the word. That's extraction. When you do that, then essentially you're going from text-oriented, unstructured data to relational data. And you can do much more with it, as we described earlier. So for now, actually think in terms of, we're only doing text retrieval, even for dynamic pages. And in fact, I'm not even talking about dynamic pages. You know, let's just talk about existing pages. Okay? Other questions? So let me do like a quick discussion of crawlers. Again, it's one more very important topic. It's a hugely, it's an important engineering topic. You should read a paper on Mercator that is available on the readings list. Some of you are probably much more of an engineer than I am, and you might actually enjoy these things. That's why I'm sort of doing, what is that? You know, I'm being upfront about the fact that I may not be doing as good a job on telling you the crawling technology. But let me tell you the basic ideas. So you retrieve web pages essentially for the search engines, and they're all over the place. So what do? You have to start with some number of pages, take the links that are in those pages, go there, get those pages, take the links on those pages, go further. That's basically what you're supposed to do. Now, clearly if you do this, at some point of time, it is possible that there are parts of the web that are not connected, and you would not get there. Okay, if you have a page that has not been connected to any other page in the world, and you put a huge firewall around it, then, yeah, you really made sure that you won't be found and nobody will find you. Okay, but if you by mistake give the URL of the page to your friend and that friend puts it in some favorites list, then off with you, because favorite lists are also crawled. And so you get to that page. Okay, but essentially that's what crawling is. Now the question, of course, is the big questions are, in fact, this issue. The crawling for general search engines is quite a different deal from crawling for specialized search engines. Okay, one thing that I want you to understand is, even though Googles and Yahoos of the world are particularly interesting because everybody knows about them, they're already there. You don't need more than one reasonable search engine. Okay? And you already have one reasonable one. So, however, what you might want to do is to have topic-specific search engines that deal with user populations that are more choosy. Okay? So, a search engine just for computer science people, a search engine just for biologists, a search engine only for bicycling enthusiasts. Okay, now when you do that, in a sense, you have much fewer people interested in your search engine, but you have more opportunities. Whereas general search engine, one reasonable one is good enough. So you have to keep that in mind. Okay, and this is sort of connected to this long tail issue that we talked about, and that I'll come back to again when we talk about power law distributions as part of social networks. So you can have specialized crawlers. We will not differentiate them for now. There is actually one topic on focus crawling that I might mention little later in the course because it's connected to classification learning and crawling together. Okay, but that's for specialized crawlers. Now the big issues for any normal crawler is which page to look at next and how to avoid overloading a site. Okay, and because if you're crawling, then you're sending multiple HTTP requests to the servers, and if the server dies, then they will try to stop you from accessing their site. That's not good. And how deep within a site would you go? You may have one link to it, and then you get the page, and then there are links on that page. How much further down would you go? And how frequently do you visit the pages? Because this is connected to the fact that pages change. Okay. Now, as I said, ultimately the answers for these are engineering answers. There is nothing that, oh my God, I would never have thought about it. But good engineering is like that. I mean, a whole bunch of reasonable ideas put together in the right combination. You know, there's nothing surprising about Brooklyn Bridge. I mean, I'm sure people in Greek times would have said, yeah, you could build a bridge in theory. The surprising thing about Brooklyn Bridge is everything came together and the darn thing hasn't fallen apart yet. Right? That's the interesting part. And so, in a way, all of these have answers, but getting the set of answers, the right set of answers, which will work together well in combination, is a good engineering task. Yes?
Sir, if I have a website for a particular organization, say, and it has its own search engine, does it do a traditional IR or does it do this? Because if it has to do this, it has to have crawlers which do topical search. Say if I'm having a general website with all the doctors in the world, and if that website has a search option,
mm-hmm.
it has normally a website of Google search plus
mm-hmm.
site search.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a topical crawler that you're talking about that which goes?
No, that's not what is a topical crawler. That is basically site-specific search engine.
I mean, if
and what might
doctors. I mean, in the whole world, so that could take information from any other place.
Yeah, see, the idea is the site-specific search engines typically might provide you, so here is the deal. What are the top 10 results on your site for this query? Is a completely different answer from what are the top 10 results for this query on the web as a whole. Because there are many more. So, for example, if you said CSE 494 to Google, I think until recently it used to be the case that my course would be the first result, but I think now it's no longer the one. Okay? You could help me by putting links to it, but you know that's a different story. But in ASU, I would come higher. Or at least more importantly, the top 10 results would be all ASU specific. Whereas the top 10 results on Google don't have to be. So you have provided extra implicit semantics and keywords that the user didn't provide. Okay. Topic specific search engine is a different issue, which is you still are crawling across sites, but getting pages that are most likely to be about bicycling, getting pages that are most likely to be about computer science papers. Okay. For example, scholar.google.com, right, is a search engine which is only for academic dweebs, and it only crawls places which have PDF files, PS files, etc., which correspond to technical documents. And then they do interesting types of support that nobody else cares about, but academic people care a lot about. They, for example, talk about what are the papers on this area and who seems to be citing this paper, and you know how many citations are there, who does this paper cite, all this stuff, which is something very useful. Okay. So that's the difference between topic specific versus site specific, topic specific crawling versus site specific search. So anyway, these are the main general issues. Now, one thing that it's one of these things that there is this robot exclusion protocol. You could have robot.txt in your directory, and the first thing they do is ignore that file and crawl everything anyway, because it's a unenforced, nothing on web is enforced. And so robots.txt, essentially, in that page, you can tell, please Google, do not crawl this page. Yahoo, you can go ahead and crawl this page. And then, of course, Google will crawl it multiple times because you said Google. Right? And then they'll say, we're surprised that you had this. But in general, if you look at it, okay, this is one of these things where if you look at the logs of your web page, right, everybody, every crawler first looks for robots.txt and then ignores it and does the rest. Okay, so you're supposed to call it, otherwise you're not a good citizen. The question is whether you use it. But anyway, it's a nice little protocol. It allows you to give rights to the it's like basically putting, you know, signs on your door saying, robots, you can come up into my living room, but please don't go into the bedroom and steal my laptop. And then, you know, if they if they read your directions and follow it, that's fine. If not, you know, you have at least the directions. So the robot.txt is a nice protocol for giving those directions. And, you know, in theory, it works well because it actually gets you to say, this whole directory tree, don't crawl. This other directory, you can crawl. So you can keep parts of your web page uncrawlable. Okay. So there is a format for it. Now this, let's put a little more time before we end, and we'll come back to this a little bit more next time. So here is like a general crawler architecture. This is the Mercator Spider architecture, which is actually quite, it's one of the ones where there's a big paper written on the crawler, and I have it on the readings list. So you can read it to get all the engineering issues involved. Okay, so here are the steps involved, what Mercator does. It gets a, it has a huge queue of URLs to be crawled. It's initialized to some set of URLs that they picked. And then basically it starts this process, it's a big loop. Pick a URL from the queue, okay, and then simulate the protocols, basically send the HTTP, Gopher, FTP, etc. Now in fact, things like Gopher, do any of you even remember what a Gopher protocol is? You do, so you're older than some of the rest of these guys. you should have not said it. So Gopher is one of the older protocols. FTP is even older, but it survived. Gopher just went away, I don't know where it went. HTTP protocol, for example. So these are the various protocols through which the pages can be accessed. So you look at the URLs, figure out what protocol it's using, and then send a link, send a request with respect to that. Okay, and then read in the information from the document. Then, having read the information from the document, you have to ask yourself, have I seen this document already? Because if I've seen this document already, then I don't want to put it into my library. Because, you know, everything on this document has already been seen, and it'll just put me into a nice loop. You know, I call this document, and then it says go to this link, then I call that document, says go to this original document, and crawler can be happily doing a depth first search. Okay? So then, how do you see whether document has been seen before? The best idea is plagiarism detection, which is basically like shingle-based analysis, but you don't want to get into that. Okay? Instead, normally what you do is you do checksums and fingerprints. The idea is you're not really looking for near duplicates, but you're looking for exact duplicates. For exact duplicates, you know, checksums and fingerprints are reasonable. Okay. If it has not been seen before, then you go into the page and extract the links from the page. Now, what's interesting, of course, is in an HTML page, links can be all over the place. You know, it can be part of the direct text, it can be part of the style sheets, it can be part of image links, it can be part of anywhere. And some of the URLs are directly provided with the absolute address, some are provided with the relative address. Now, none of this is exactly PhD level material. But if you don't do it well, then you got a whole bunch of URLs that all will fail, the access seeks will fail, and you know, you haven't crawled most of the web. Okay. Again, think of it in the Brooklyn Bridge analogy. Not any one of those, you know, bolts, I'm sure if I'm given a reasonable sized, you know, bolt tightener, I could have done it. Anybody could have done it. That's not the thing. It's just doing all of them together. That's engineering. And now, if you extract the links, and then each of these links are ready to be put into the queue, a frontier queue. which is the open list. If you are from the 471 terminologies of search engines, search algorithms, think of this queue as the open list. The moment you think of this as the open list, you should start asking yourself, should I do breadth first, depth first, A-star search, and things like that. I mean, since you have the mallet, hammer, you can ask yourself that question. Then if this is a new URL, you can go add it to the URL queue. But when you add it to the queue, you get to prioritize them. You can put it in the beginning, you can put it in the end, you can put it in the right place. That's the whole search algorithm. Okay? And then, that's it. Okay, so you basically do this repeatedly. Now, when do you stop? Presumably when your queue has become empty. There's nothing to crawl anymore. Okay, at which point you restart. And in fact, that's a whole entire different issue, which is of the URLs that you have crawled, are there URLs that you have to re-crawl? In fact, within this architecture, you can say any URL whose document has been accessed, you can throw it back onto the queue with a low priority. Say, come back to it 15 days later, such that you'll always have something in the queue. And the old guys, just go back to the back of the queue and then come back front again. Okay. So from high level, that's what crawling does. We'll look at more details next time. And then the main issue next time would be two things. One, of course, is this exploiting tags on the web pages to improve the retrieval. And also one of the tags is anchor text, which is a very different beast than anything else. Okay, because anchor text ultimately is the is the force behind all the Google bombs which you heard of. Okay. And then we will talk about how to improve, go beyond the retrieval based on text, and then talk about trust-based ranks. For that, we'll get into the social network. So about one-fourth or half into the class, I will shift into social network. And the web slides for that are also available. Okay? Stop.